Hey everybody, Shane Presley here with Rock Paper Podcast. Want to invite you out to this year's third annual Rock Paper Podcast birthday show being held July 1st, 7 p.m. over at the Firebird in St. Louis, Missouri. This year's lineup includes Hounds, the Royal Furs, Forgetting January, and Bald Eagle Mountain, hosted by comedian John Venegoni. We'll have Gorilla Street Food also there, sling up some delicious meals from their food truck, and sponsored by Four Hands Brewery. So local music, local food, local beer, and local venue. So it's going to be a great time. Come on out, $8 in advance, $10 day of show, and we're going to have a great time. I'm really excited about this, and we can't wait to see you there. All details can be found at rockpaperpodcast.com or firebirdstl.com. Hey everybody, Shane Presley here with Rock Paper Podcast. I want to tell you about my friends over at Music Record Shop. Find them over there at the Dot Zach building located in the Grand Center area. You can come by each and every Friday. They have an all-new music happy hour going on. Live record spinning, free beer from Urban Chestnut, 15% off pre-orders, and you can come pick up new records from Jeff Tweedy, Iron Maiden, Big Boy, King Gizzard, and the Lizard Wizard. You can find all full listing of details at musicrecordshop.com. You can shop online there 24/7. Be sure to follow along on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as well. They're always giving away records and tickets, and live in stores they promote on there, and all kinds of things. So it pays to support. Shop local, everybody, and go check out Music Record Shop.
Podcast is kind of like it's like a radio show that's not on the radio. It's on the internet. Does that make sense?
Uh-huh.
Yeah. That's also like my mom. It makes it sound more confusing, doesn't it? It sounds like this.
This is St. Louis musician Marcus Newstead, and you're listening to the Rock Paper Podcast.
Rock Paper Podcast.
Hey everybody, Shane Presley here, Rock Paper Podcast, coming to you from St. Louis, Missouri, hanging out today with Marcus Newstead.
Hi Shane.
Hey man.
How are you?
I'm wonderful, how are you?
I'm good, it's my day off.
Yeah man.
My weekend has begun.
We're hanging out here at Pfister Practice Space, located at Encapsulated Studios.
Technically Maplewood, Missouri.
Yeah, Maplewood. But yeah, I've been down here a couple times. And
the crown jewel of the county.
Yeah. It's a beautiful little space, man, we got. When you walked up, I followed the sounds of the guitar as you were tuning up and stuff. But yeah, it sounded good, man.
Coming into our gear locker here.
Yeah.
This is all of our retirement right here, pretty much. This is all, if it all goes south, we can just sell the shit in this room and pay some bills if we need
sure.
to. It'll never come to that, hopefully, thank God. But we're going to be okay. We have enough gear to backline a festival in here.
Right.
And we still had to, as you saw when you rolled up, we have to pull a good deal of it out, actually, to rehearse. There's only two bands that rehearse in here, but we got about seven bands worth of stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But yeah, man, we've been getting to know each other a little bit lately, being co-workers now.
Yeah.
And stuff, which is, it's cool for me, like, because I've definitely heard the name Pfister a little bit and stuff, but then like we both started working, you were already there, but I started working at Broadway Oyster Bar, and I saw you around down there and stuff, and then I've joked with you a couple of times. I always thought you had like a twin brother running around because you keep your hair all up and stuff, and then once you're off shift, your hair comes down. You
want to put my civilian clothes back
on. Yeah, but you know, it was just cool to find out get to know you a little more through working and stuff. And this podcast is a good excuse for me to get to hang out and get to know more about you besides talking at the bar and everything else. So, where does it all start, man? Do you grow up here in St. Louis? Or
no, actually, I'm a transplant to the St. Louis area. I'm a Missouri resident lifelong. I was born and raised in a town called Ironton, Missouri. It's about an hour and a half south of here. Off the beaten path, about 20 minutes away from Highway 67, Farmington, Missouri. It's a bigger town around where I'm from.
All right.
But that's where I grew up. But I moved to St. Louis in 2007.
Yeah.
'07, as I've been trying to train myself to. I graduated in '02, moved to St. Louis in '07. it's folksy, man. That's I try to be very proper with the year. But no, I moved to St. Louis 10 years ago.
Yeah.
But I grew up in Ironton, Missouri.
To focus on music?
Or? Yeah, exactly. I was playing with a band called McCree. We were around town till 2012. But I knew some friends. I had been jamming with them up here, and the commute was hell. I just didn't want to make the commute anymore. And so a couple friends of ours got together. We got a house up in Florissant off Charbonnier Avenue, and I've lived here since then. Yeah. I love it. I moved to South City in 2008, and I've been in South City now since then.
Yeah.
Mainly for music. It was an hour from Farmington to St. Louis. I worked in Farmington. I was living in Ironton. I was staying up here most nights and crashing at friends' houses and stuff. And then I just decided the commute's not worth it. Got a job up here, which is funny because Kenny, who plays bass in Pfister with me, was my manager at Office Max in Brentwood. We worked in the print department. He hired me. He got me a job up here. So I owe him my step into the professional world, which is funny too. We ended up working at the Creepy Crawl together too, before the Creepy Crawl shut down at its Washington Avenue location. But I moved up here for music, and I haven't looked back since.
Yeah.
I was in a band, and we were based out of Farmington, and this label guy told us that I can't sign you guys because it's not that you're not good enough. You're not from a big city. Nobody cares about bands that are from small towns. Huh. So it kind of made me say, like, well, what difference does it make? And I get it. It totally makes a difference. So you throw a show in your hometown and 150 people show up to it. Big deal. They don't care. You know, you go to a town that no one's ever heard of you in and nobody will come. You know, you just got to get out and do that. And the guy told us that. He's like, I'd love to sign you guys, but there's no one that will buy your records because you've never been on tour, this, that, and the other thing. So that really kind of stuck with us. So we had done a little bit of regional touring when we were younger. When I was like 19, we went on our first tour, and it was like a 10-day thing. Actually, before that, I went. There was this old tour called the Taste of Chaos Tour. Okay. It was kind of in conjunction with the Warped Tour ilk.
Right.
What's the guy's name? Kevin Lyman. It was his tour. It was his Winter Warp Tour, they call it. And a local band called Sophomore, do you remember them?
Yeah, I know the name. I don't think
they were a really big rock band in St. Louis for a long time. They were awesome. They were one of the first bands that kind of embraced the rock revival kind of Motley Crue-esque. I hate that shit, Motley Crue, but I love rock and roll. And they were the first kind of band around St. Louis. There was a lot of bands doing it, like straight rock bands, like Low Freak and some other, like Gas Off and other bands that were doing the rock and roll thing. They crossed over from the emo sort of scene into the hard rock scene, which is where they sort of had their obscurity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're like, well, they're playing this like guitar solos and shit, and while these kids were like trying to jam out some sad emo jams, and they weren't playing that, and they kind of went tank. They were older than a lot of the guys, which I found myself become the young guy in the scene now with Pfister and heavy metal and stuff. But yeah, so I went on tour with them for 2 weeks as a fill-in bass player, played the first night with them, and then Bob, the singer and bass player, decided that he would rather just play bass and sing too, so I became the merch guy, and then pimped my band that I was in at home, you know, for the longest time. And then after that, my new band went on tour, and then from there on out, it was just like, you know, you got to go on tour to do stuff.
Yeah,
got to get on the road. So that's why I moved to St. Louis. It's essentially the crux of me making the decision to move to St. Louis just to play music came when the guy told us, you got to get out of the small town. You got to go to the big city, at least to start getting a name going for yourself.
Right. Yeah, I mean, I can kind of get that. Like, I got some buddies that, travel quite a ways just to play in St. Louis because there is so many other options to play in town and audience and everything else. There's a lot more activity, obviously, than a small town. But
yeah.
I don't know. I don't know about that people wouldn't buy your records because you're from a small town.
It's hero culture. They want to buy records from people that they identify with. And it's funny because you can be home. They call it the hometown hero syndrome. You can be the hometown hero all you want, but you get out of there and no one cares.
Sure.
You know? I mean, it's a lot of bands have that mentality. Like, we'll be big shit in hometown, but then you get on the road and nobody cares. That nobody cares. That's why I've always... That's why any band that I was in, that I've been in and I ever will be in, playing on the road is essential. I mean, I love traveling with it. That's the biggest part of... writing and recording is one thing, but being able to, like, go out and play to people who may have heard you is cool, but the fact you're playing to people who haven't heard of you is even better. And the more people that see you play, you think the theory is, the more people that see you play, the more successful that you get. But it takes a lot more work than that.
Yeah.
But being on the road and the willing to go on the road and do it is a big thing that a lot of people overlook. It's hell sometimes. I mean, it's hell. And I've done a thimble's worth drop in a bucket compared on the road compared to some of the people that I know that I've become friends with, the guys that are playing, you know, 200 out of town shows a year.
Right.
That's nuts to me to think. I mean, we did our Pfister played our 100th show, and then that year we went from 100 shows to 150. Like, we added, like, we had only played 100 shows as a band up to that point, but then that next year we added half as many more shows on top. It just starts to accumulate, you know?
Right.
And I see these guys out there playing 250 shows a year, 300 shows a year on the road, and I'm just baffled by it. But, sometimes you just got to do that. We've been very fortunate that we don't have to... we can do it if we want to, but we don't. We have just chose not to. Kirk and Kenny are both married. They're both fathers. I am practically married. I have a great full-time job that is cool enough to let me do that stuff. So the road aspect is really intriguing, and that was what drew me to St. Louis.
Right.
Because you can be a working musician here.
Yeah.
You really can.
For sure, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talk a lot about it with several of the bands that come on the show and artists and stuff, with, like, you know, how I deal St. Louis, excuse me, how ideal St. Louis is to tour out of, because it's right in the middle of the map. It's
everywhere. Yeah, you can get anywhere.
Yeah, so it's nice to hear that people are, like I was saying, being able to be a working musician out of St. Louis and tour and do great things. So so we're talking about, when you mentioned Pfister and stuff, you got, you said you got like four bands.
Yeah.
Right?
Well,
Technically
yeah. Four bands. Yeah. So with Pfister, then I play guitar alongside some incredible guys in a band called Daybringer, who I've known for about 10 years now. Four fifths of the guys that are in Daybringer were in that band McCree.
Okay.
I mentioned before. And then I play guitar, second guitar, in a band called Grand Inquisitor, who has done some touring with Pfister, who's been around for a long time. Graham Collins is a good friend of mine. He kept that band going heavy throughout the city and did some touring with us, and it's made some incredible records, and now that I've joined the band, we've changed the sound completely. It's crazy. It's just completely different band now, but doing that now. And then I have a group that we do improv shows. It's basically we get together with no plan other than just to play for about 20 minutes, 25 minutes straight, called Past Life Tiger. So Daybringer, I play with a guy named John Clark, a guy named Brian Bear, a guy named Mike Walsh, and a guy named Dan Keenest, who are all amazing musicians. Yeah. Grand Inquisitor, I got Jerry Rose and Spencer Medley playing drums. Jerry's on bass. Graham Collins is the madman that runs that band and graciously has let me play guitar. And then Past Life Tiger is Calvin McRoy and Tony Saputo. Calvin did some time in a band called Not Waving But Drowning and many other awesome bands around town, and has been just one of the most amazing drummers I've ever heard in my life. And Tony Saputo was the front man for a great, I don't even know how to describe them, insanely maddening crossover metal, jazz, fusion band called Lie By Mistake that did a lot of road work as well, too. Did a lot of time on the road. And then I play in Pfister with Kirk Gatterer plays the drums and Kenny Snarzik plays bass. Kenny did some time in bands around town. He was the vocalist for this hardcore band called This Incredible Machine, which eventually became the band Ashes and Iron. way back in the day, was in a band called The Fifth Element. Yeah. And people, old heads around town, remember The Fifth Element.
That was Jack, wasn't it? Jack?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He's become a good buddy of mine.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, Kenny was the DJ in Fifth Element.
Yeah.
We all have sorted pasts. Yeah. I played in basically like a emo kind of band for a long time, and I think everyone. I think everyone has. Probably not. Actually, there are way cooler people that I hang out with that don't even have any or have been cool their whole lives. So.
Right.
Yeah. I have no coolness. I'm a tourist. I'm a coolness tourist, man. I got nothing to offer.
Yeah. Well, Pfister, I know a little bit about, and you guys. I mean, this is pretty heavy stuff.
It's become. It's. I don't know, man. It's funny that it has become my main focus.
Right.
It's very funny. It started out as I lived with Kenny over in South City at 3424 Hartford Avenue. We just called it 3424. That's the apartment, and we were just drinking all the time. I mean, drinking all the time. We worked at the Creepy Crawl, so it was very home to work, just hanging out. And Kenny, when I moved in with Kenny, I learned a lot more about metal than I had ever thought was possible. Kenny is, among many guys that I've met since I've moved to St. Louis, one of the greatest palettes as far as broad strokes go in any genre, really. But Kenny really taught me about a lot of stuff that I was aware of but really had no appreciation for. Got me into bands like Yob. Got me into Neurosis, who I was a fan of for a long time, but kind of really got me more involved in them, and like bands like Burning Witch, and very heavy, just very heavy stuff that I was sort of just, I had heard of this stuff going on, but I never explored it because it never, didn't jump out to me because I was all about the song, still am all about just good songs, you know? Mm-hmm. And it took having Kenny show me some of these bands that write longer songs, slower songs, heavier songs than what people were conceived or perceiving as heavy at right. the time. You know, you have like in the hardcore and metal community, you have this the slower the better for the breakdown or whatever you have. But these songs were like just a breakdown the whole song. It was just brutal and slow. And Kenny kind of got me focused on that, and we just. Built on it. There were nights where we would just stay up getting stoned and listening to Yob records with a movie playing with no audio, and we'd sync it up to Quantum Mystic by Yob, and just, you know, it was crazy. Just, I had a really, like, really awesome learning experience with it. You talked with John McVeigh about how when he joined up with Larry Davis, and they were in Detroit, and they put him in that room to get himself acquainted, you know? Kind of feel like that was like my time with Kenny at 3424, and just guys teaching me a lot of stuff. Like I was into Metallica and Slayer and Iron Maiden and the Big Four and traditional heavy metal and stuff, but the more extreme stuff, the death metal and stuff that I was into when I was younger too, like Cannibal Corpse and stuff like that, and Morbid Angel and stuff. It was skateboard music, mm-hmm. So I would do that, and then when I joined up with Kenny and became better friends with Kenny, he sort of got me into the slower stuff. And then from there on out, we just started writing music together. I had a guitar and I tuned it way down and had a Turbo Rat, and plugged it right into GarageBand and just was playing these riffs, and they sounded, you know, like Sleep, and it sounded like Neurosis, and it sounded like Yob, and it sounded like Burning Witch and stuff. And we just started writing these songs on GarageBand. We would pick a day and we would just get fucked up and write a song.
Yeah.
And we got to where it was like starting to sound cohesive. And we're like, okay, well, we were taking time. We were putting time into it. And it became clear that it was something we're going to put time into. We may as well start doing it. So we started putting drum beats to it, and we made a demo, and we put it on the internet. Originally, now this is where the joke aspect of the band comes in. I mean, the band's called Pfister. We originally wanted to call the band Fisted Sister. Which tragically was taken by a band in, I believe, Dallas, Texas. Kenny knows, but
yeah.
A band in Dallas, Texas has that name. And we decided to compromise and went with Pfister.
Right.
And we called our first record the Fisted Sister Demo. We sent that out on the internet, and this Italian metal blog called The Sludge Swamp is run by this awesome woman named Mari, who we actually met when we went to Europe a couple years ago. She went to both our shows in Italy, I think. I know she was at the one in Milan. I don't think she was at the one in Bologna. She was at our show in Milan. We met her for the first time, but she broke us. She was the first person to take the band seriously because we didn't. And she took it very seriously and wrote a very heartfelt review of the first demo, and it was demo songs that we were getting stoned. Bong rips in a bedroom. That's what I called that. That's what the EP should be called, because that's what it was. Yeah. To be quite honest with you. And we just started writing more and more songs, and it became more elaborate. And then we got offered people were hitting us up to getting Kenny up to play shows. Like, hey, is your thing a thing? Like, not really, no. You know, we're not really a band. We don't have a drummer. We're thinking about asking this guy. And a guy that we all, at this point, Fubar had opened, and we knew we were down there working and helping out and going to shows. And I had a band that was practicing there at the time. McCree was practicing there at the time. And we ran into a guy, Kirk, who played for, he was a drummer in this band called the Bridge Burners, punk rock band, hardcore punk rock kind of. Just a heavy punk rock band. Mm-hmm. With some guys that are in the band, the Supermen, and a couple other bands around town. And then he played drums in a band called Texas Justice for a little bit, that I filled in on bass for too, as well, for a little bit. And we asked him, and he said, yeah, and we taught him the songs, and we got asked to. Bruce Lamont's band Yakuza was coming through town, and Kenny knows Bruce from way back, and asked, hey, is your thing ready? We're like, yeah, not really. So we played our first show with a different drummer than we have, because Kirk, I hadn't got all the songs learned, I guess, for that show. Or, man, it was so long ago. The circumstances for which he didn't play the first show with us, yeah. I believe, are because we booked it right. We booked it like a month after. Like, we had just started jamming with Kirk, and we booked the show, and he didn't know all the songs yet. And then another guy that we played with, we taught him. I don't even think he had jammed on some of the songs that we played that show. We had a second guitar player too as well that show. So it was a shit show. I'm sure it wasn't that good. I don't remember. I was drunk. And then we got asked to open for I Hate God, and then Weed Eater, and then we started playing more high profile shows, and it just became more and more serious. Right. We wrote real songs. We got to the point where we did a real first album, and it was my side. It was the side band. You know, I'd moved to St. Louis for this other band. Thister starts up, and then it slowly flipped on me and became the most important. I mean, I believe Daybringer and Grand Inquisitor are all as equally as important, the same amount of work into every band that I'm in.
Sure.
But I feel like Thister becoming the main band where I've been awarded the most opportunities in my life with. Right. It's just insane to me. I still think to this day it's just because you let go and do what is easy for you, but not because it's easy to do, maybe because it comes out so easy. Mm-hmm. You know, I hate forcing myself to be creative. And I feel like for years, and a lot of guys in the rock and roll game would probably agree with me on this, either you play music you don't like to play because it's a paycheck, or you are creatively dead and tired by the time you get to be a certain age. And you just stop wanting to do it. Your yearning for creativity goes away.
Right.
So Thister is, in a weird way, in its simplicity and how easy it is for me to visualize and come up with heavy metal riffs and heavy metal concepts. It's just natural. It's very natural. It all comes out. I don't feel forced whatsoever writing this music at all.
I sat with Jimmy Tebow of the Schwag a while back, and he had a very similar story to go along with yours about, you know, had several different bands going at the time, and he started the Schwag in like 91 or something, 26 years ago he's been at it. But he was saying, like, you know, he had all these other things. He did stuff with Jerry Garcia band and all this, and then and the Schwag was always this kind of joke goof thing he had going, and all of a sudden now it's become his main project.
It's his livelihood.
Yeah, he tours the country playing as the Schwag.
And I've never made money playing music at all other than Thister.
Right.
And that's not to say that I make a lot of money with it, because we don't. We are now to the point where we go out and we get paid for what we do. Yeah. You know what I mean?
Sure.
It's not like we're not sinking money into the band. The band is becoming very sentient. Mm-hmm. We're being awarded opportunities now. So.
Yeah. You said you wanted to share a Pfister tune on this show, and a song called "We All Died Tonight."
Yes, sir.
You said it was on a split single with a group called Teeth.
Yeah, Teeth right there from California. Beautiful death metal band. Terrifying, truly terrifying their music is.
All right.
It's very good contrast where we take it slow, they take it fast. Yeah, and the song, the title of the song is lifted from a Wu-Tang lyric as well.
All right.
Yes.
I'm hoping it happens. I think they're working on it. But my buddies put together a shirt design the other day, kind of a spoof on the Wu-Tang logo.
Oh yeah.
It's got the W and all that still there, but instead of the Wu, it was a picture of Ric Flair.
Oh man, that's awesome! That's incredible.
Yeah. So hopefully that happens.
Nice.
So I'll definitely buy one of those.
Oh, for sure. That's good. I'm not even that into wrestling, but I probably do that.
Sure. Yeah.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I love there's a couple of different shirt sites that I check out, but they do a lot of that kind of mashing culture together. There's a lot of comic book superhero type of stuff, and like in a different take on it. Like I've seen Beavis and Butthead dressed as like Iron Man and Captain America.
Oh, cool.
That type of
tweak
thing.
Tweak it. Yeah.
Yeah, they just take two different cultures and mash them together.
That's awesome.
And it's called Ripped Apparel, RIPT.
Okay.
And cool. Anyway, I really like what they do. But I just love that kind of idea. Just like it takes two of my favorite things.
That's awesome. My buddy Spooky is really into that stuff.
Yeah. One of my favorites I bought the most recently is a shirt. It was it's the like kind of the Nintendo Mario Brothers 8-bit graphic kind of a cartridge,
like that slanted diagonal, like he's jumping.
But it's with the Blues Brothers.
Oh, that's cool. Yeah, that's cool, man.
Yeah,
I like that.
Right.
That's pretty cool.
So I like that kind of stuff. But
that's really cool.
But anyway, we're gonna share this tune. We All Died Tonight. You can grab it over at Bandcamp.com. Anything you want to share with this song?
No, I wrote a guitar solo for this song that I'm pretty proud of. That's about it. I'm not a flashy guitar player at all. I'm very much a rhythm guitar player, and the end of the song just kind of called for something. We were working on this riff and it was feeling real good, and we looped it a couple times to kind of get Kirk really is the star of the whole song. Kirk's all over the place for our kind of music for this kind of stuff. But now I got to write a guitar solo for the song that I am pretty proud of. That I am scared to play and mess up. But yeah. Yeah, there you go.
Curse my ride.
mentioned John McVay earlier, and mm-hmm. friend of the show, and great guy, great guitar player. And I used to jam with him a little bit on Monday nights over at Oyster Bar, right?
Yes, sir.
Soulard Blues open jam over there.
Mm-hmm.
Which I think is, you know, like, I love that you, there's this, the heavy side of you, but you also love the blues.
And stuff. Oh, man, I love all music. Yeah. I love all music. I can get down on anything.
Right.
Truly, I can. I love a good written song. A well-written song is more important to me than most things. You know, it takes... Any idiot can pick a guitar up or a piano or a harp or a fucking violin and get something out of it. But when you write a good song, whether it be complicated, whether it be simple, that's the beauty of it. That's why I like it a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Especially, well, with McVay, man, is I watch him playing guitar. It's like it's a clinic, man.
Yeah.
And I've been playing music for 20 years now, and that's again, nothing compared to most people that I know personally or that are around. And it's a learning experience.
Mm-hmm.
It really is. One of the main reasons I like to watch that guy play, other than him being a good friend of mine now, we've become pretty good friends, and we hang out every so often at his gigs and stuff like that. But it's just like watching someone play an instrument and really getting having a voice, a musician's voice. I think anybody can play an instrument, but to have a voice with it, That's really what I admire about him the most, and that's why I watch him so much.
Yeah.
And why I really appreciate what he does and what he's been doing for music for 40 years now.
Yeah, man. Yeah, he's the man.
40 plus years.
Check out John McVay Band all around.
Every Wednesday at Hammerstone's, yeah. Bud.
Do you ever think about putting together a blues band or doing anything like that?
I would never presume at this point in my life, man. I'm still learning a lot. There's it's those guys' lives, you know. I feel like a tourist every time I jam. You know, like I've mentioned, I have a coolness tourist by all means, but I'm a musician first and foremost, and I like jamming with competent musicians, and the blues jam is awesome when I get a chance to get with Rob Lee, the drummer, and with John. And if I play guitar with John to the left and Art Dwyer to the right, I've got awesomeness surrounding me, and I have always subscribed to the school of play with musicians that are better than you. Makes you better as a musician, makes you appreciate good music, and that's a no-brainer on Mondays. It's a no-brainer with every band I play, and I am not the strongest musician in any of the groups I play, and I've never been in my life because I try to find a band where there are guys I learn from. Now, technically speaking, I think I might be a better bass player than Kenny is in Pfister, and he would be the first person to agree with you on that. But his attitude is of the bass player. He's got a songwriter quality to him. He doesn't play a bass. He's for the unit, which is mm-hmm. what I am. I'm never, like I said, I'm not a flashy guy. Not a flashy guy at all. I just love playing guitar. I love playing guitar. But I came up a bass player, actually. I played bass. My first instrument was bass when I was 13. I've turned 33 this year, so I'm now 20 years in the game now,
yeah.
Playing music. So I started out as a bass player, and the first band I was in, I was playing bass. And I went to college, did jazz, a lot of jazz combos, and the jazz ensemble at the school, did my music theory classes and stuff, composition. Got out of college with a degree in music theory and composition, and played bass in a hardcore band, you know? Like, it's so funny that I use it to my advantage in the fact that it makes me just really appreciate music as a whole. Again, any kind of genre. I really can get down with almost everything. I will say I don't like the recent rap country that we're getting right now.
Yeah.
I think it's just confusing. Sure. I was in a car the other day, and it was modern country radio, and it was a guy with he was flowing. It was like it was really weird. Didn't expect to hear that. We joked 20 years ago about how funny it would be if country artists started rapping, and now we're mm-hmm. here. The future's here.
There was somebody, if I'm blanking on who the quote came from now, but they were saying something along the lines that now that rap country is for white kids that are scared of black people or something.
That's what it sounds like. I mean, it's like that's the real sentiment I kind of got from it. It's very oxymoronic
right. When
you think about it. You get this concert full of people, they're throwing their hands up and vibing, but then would completely walk across the street to avoid a black person in their hometown. It's baffling to me. The racism of it all makes me sick.
Sure.
Yeah. Makes me sick. I get it, man. I mean, it bums me out.
Yeah.
It bums me out.
I don't know. There's, I get in, like I said, I went with you, man. I get into about it a little bit of everything, but yeah, there's this, there's some of that, definitely that bro country stuff. That,
it's bro country is the perfect word to describe. I'm gonna get a beer real quick.
So you do have a couple of Pfister dates, while we're talking about them. On July 26th, you guys will be at the Sinkhole.
Yeah, with black metal band False from Minneapolis. And incredible
then,
band.
Then you said you guys are heading to Vegas doing a big show.
Psycho Las Vegas. We fly out to Las Vegas to play. We play the 18th of August at the Hard Rock Hotel Casino. It's called the Vinyl Stage. There's many stages, I think, for the festival. But we got a pretty good slot, man. Opening night, we got a good slot in the evening. We're not playing at like 2 in the morning or at like noon. So we got a nice, I think we go on at 10:20, I believe.
Nice.
But our night's awesome. We've got Sleep, The Melvins, Carcass is our night, I believe. I think Brian Jonestown Massacre is our night, I think, too. Sumac, Chelsea Wolf, Cult of Luna with Julie Christmas is our night, I think. Chemist, who we played with back in April in St. Louis, is our night, too. We're staying the whole weekend, though. I'm going to see Neurosis. I'm going to see Ace Frehley. I'm going to see King fucking Diamond. Oh, man. It's just, we have this, it's an incredible thing. We submitted for it. We were on tour last year. Kenny was, we were in a hotel, actually. Motel. Let's be honest here, Shane. It was a motel. It was a motel. And there was open submission, I think, or there was we got hip to a way to submit for the festival, and we didn't think we'd get it, and the guy got back to us before the tour was over. I want to say he might have got back to us like within a week from whenever we submitted, and was like, "Yeah, you guys are in." And then it was very speculative for a long time, and we got announced that we were playing Austin Terror Fest down in Austin, Texas, which is a branch from Southwest Terror Fest. And they actually just had Northwest Terror Fest in Seattle. But we were down in Austin for the Terror Fest, and I think the official word came down that we were, in fact, going to be on Psycho Las Vegas. So it was Psycho California a couple years ago, and then last year was Psycho Las Vegas. And last year's headliners was Alice Cooper and Blue Oyster Cult.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and this year, I mean, with King Diamond, and then Mastodon is one of the nights, and then Brian Jonestown Massacre, but Ace Frehley, I mean, it's nuts. I mean, it's legit pretty big music festival that I find funny that it leans towards the heavy metal, hardcore, doom metal, and there's Wolves in the Throne Room, one of the best American black metal bands, is playing too. A lot of these bands are doing very exclusive performances for this. Inner Arma, the shirt that I'm wearing right now, Inner Arma, they're playing. They blew my mind the other day when they played with Paul Bearer. Gate Creeper, who also opened that show, one of the best death metal bands in the country right now, doing serious work. They're playing too, so we're very lucky. We've been very lucky to get on some festivals over our years. We played Roadburn in Europe, our first time to Europe, there you go. We were very lucky to get on that show. We were gonna go. We went on tour with Primitive Man from Denver to Europe a few years ago. We had 2 weeks with them, and we had an off day in the Netherlands. We couldn't. We didn't know. We didn't think we were gonna get on Roadburn, and then all of a sudden, boom, we're the opening band on Thursday. To open the whole festival up, so nice. It was cool. So we got a free day at Roadburn in the middle of this fucking amazing European tour that we got asked to go on. And then after that, we did the Austin Terror Fest, which was incredible. And then in the middle of that, we got asked to do a showcase across town at a pop up venue. Just they were doing it just for South by Southwest, and it was Power Trip, Ringworm, Pig Destroyer, who just recently started touring again with a full band now. And then the band Thou from Baton Rouge, Louisiana, who is probably the most... When I talk about road guys, Thou, by far and large, are the most insane road band that I know right now. These guys play 2 shows a day every time they go out on a road. They'll be out for 30 days, and they'll have 40 shows.
Yeah.
They'll play in... Providence, Rhode Island in the morning, then Albany, New York that night. You know, Then the next day they'll drive to Boston, play Boston during the day, and then at Boston at night they'll just do these matinee shows. And we did do a matinee show that day, and it wrecked me. I have no clue how those guys did. And Vow did three shows that day, by the way. They played at noon.
That's crazy.
They played at noon, 5, and 1 a.m. I have never seen a guy more drunk in his life play a perfect set than Andy, the guitar player from Thou. It was really impressive to watch.
Yeah.
I have to very much pace myself these days because I'm so nervous that I'm going to hit a pedal wrong, or we're bringing so much gear out with us, something's bound to fail. You put that much shit up on a stage, something's going to go wrong. And we've been very fortunate, but it's a dance to the point where now I feel like I'm always going to be the guy setting the cabinets up and wiring them to make sure everything goes right, and I have this mental checklist in my head, and I'm freaking out because there's so much shit on stage right now that was hooked up. Hopefully nothing goes wrong, and hopefully my pedals all work, and hopefully I remember what song we're playing. Hopefully I can see the set list through the fog and the lasers and shit, you know. So
that guy
played three shows in one day, and still it's just amazing to me.
Yeah.
But we got that coming up with Psycho Las Vegas. Then after that we have Doomed and Stone Fest in Indianapolis, 7th of October. And Mothership is playing that. Wolf Fat is playing that as well too. We have some friends in the area that are playing that as well. And then after that's tour.
Yeah.
And then after that we write a new record.
Very cool.
Yep.
Tell me more about this. You're the new recent addition to Grand Inquisitor.
Grand Inquisitor.
Inquisitor.
Yeah. I just joined up with those guys. I've known them for a while. Like I said, Fister did some touring with them. We did a week with them 2 years ago. We went down south. We did a couple days through Texas, and then they did a week with us, and then we continued on, but they came back to St. Louis. Yeah, I just joined up with them. I've known Graham for a couple years now. He played bass with me in a band, like a rock and roll band called Bill Clinton that I started a couple years ago with a guy I worked with, and then a guy named worked with Alex Moran, who lives in Florida now, and then a guy named John Kitchen, who low-key, one of the best drummers in town. He plays with a band called Bitter Pill. If you've seen them around, he's the drummer for Bitter Pill.
Yeah, like rock cover stuff.
Yeah, yeah, they do a lot of stuff at Ballpark Village, but they do everything. I mean, they're all over the place.
Yeah.
Awesome band, awesome players, and John Kitchen is one of the best drummers in town.
Yeah.
Big shout out to John Kitchen. I don't see that guy ever anymore, and it bums me out. But Grand Inquisitor, yeah, I just joined them, and we're writing a new record. We're kind of at the moment now. I can say we, I guess, because I'm in the band now. But we're not playing anything off anything before. It's all new. I joined, and they had this new record that they had started writing, and I kind of caught up to where they're at now, and now we're kind of conceptualizing the rest of it. So we have that going, and we have a show. Our first show is the 28th of June with Aseeve, who Fister did some dates with. Awesome band on Thrill Jockey Records. They're out of Iowa City. And then a band called Null, who is on, I believe... I think it's called Social Cancer Records. Social Cancer Records, I believe, is what their record label is. And they're called Null. And then Planet Eater, it's a local band that's playing with us. Kind of a doomy-ish band.
Yeah?
Yeah.
The Sinkhole?
The Sinkhole, yeah. 7423 South Broadway.
Yeah.
We ask that you bring $8 for a seat. Mark. If you come on down, those boys are on tour. This is just two-piece, one of the heaviest two-piece bands out there.
Yeah.
By far and large. Next to In the Company of Serpents, Jucifer, Oryx, and The Body, Aseeve is out there. Aseeve is definitely heavy as fuck.
Yeah. we're dropping a lot of band names. This would be a great drinking game for this episode.
Exactly. How many bands can Marcus name before the podcast is up?
But it's cool to see, again, you were mentioning... record labels and stuff, all that. Like, it's just cool to see that a guy like yourself, passionate about this stuff, and like these bands, you love them, and you know their labels and stuff. Like, for me as a fan of music too, I appreciate all that stuff. Just
it's my life, man.
Yeah, man.
And I appreciate the fact that you appreciate it because a lot of people don't. I mean, a lot of people are very on the surface music fans. Do you know what I mean?
Sure.
They dig it, and it's not like a. I call them nondescript music fans. People who, you ask them, what do you like to do? Well, I like to go snowboarding. I really like a nice movie on Netflix and a big bowl of popcorn. And I occasionally listen to music. That's your average music fan. It's third on the list. More than likely, it's like ninth or tenth on the list. You know, you get people who patronize music venues and have no idea what they're going to go see. They have no appreciation for the people up on the stage. They don't really know what goes into it. The old joke, and it's been memed now to hell by dad rockers everywhere. But you wouldn't have a plumber work on your bathroom and pay them $5 or whatever. You know, you wouldn't hire someone to paint your house and then, you know, say, well, the exposure is what you're being paid in. You know what I mean? Like that thing has been tried over and over and over again. But a lot of people don't really get that. I mean, it's you got to hit that. And they just believe that it's there for them, and it's other people. It's people working. More than likely, there's someone on the stage getting paid for what they're doing, and your involvement is just part of the whole experience. Your involvement, all that does is make them play better. It makes them feel better about themselves. It's like it's paying to get into the show is like giving every musician a hug.
Yeah,
you know. Paying that cover, just seeing the fact that someone wanted to pay their money to go to come watch you do what you do, it's very, very appreciated. But a lot of people, the general music fan,
right,
they don't understand that stuff, and it all comes back. It's all connected. It's all somewhere. Someone is doing something so you can watch this band, and people just don't think about that kind of stuff.
Yeah. There's nights working down there at the bar, and then I'll be like, you know, there's a $7 cover, and they're like, what, $7? And I'm like, there's 8 guys on the stage. Like,
yeah.
And they're playing for 4 hours.
How on earth do you think that they are feeding themselves tonight other than the money that they get paid here?
Right. And they're like, well, we just spent $300 on dinner. And I'm like, well.
Yeah. And usually it's like that's very inflated. Yeah, and it's right, like, sure. You spent $176 over the 7 of you.
Yeah.
You actually bitched about having to pay your own portion. So relatively, you paid about $35 for your meal tonight. And the bar doesn't pay the band. The door pays the band. We're not taking money out of the till to give the band at the end of the night.
Yeah. I don't know. Just people just expect music to be free today. I don't know. They don't get it.
The piracy has gotten out of control.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, you pay the cover, you get to see the music. That's just all there is to it.
Yeah, man.
That's all there is to it.
Speaking of working the door... I like to put your pictures up online and ask friends and fans to participate in asking some questions. And you actually got quite a bit, but it was quite a bit I didn't know about you. But also I didn't realize you also had worked the door at I guess it was Cicero's.
Yeah, that was my first door guy gig.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's see, Jay over from I guess, until this weekend.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Cicero's resting.
Right, end of an era.
Yeah, man.
End of an era.
It's sad stuff, man. But Jay writes in, strangest show you ever worked at the door at Cicero's 40.
The strangest show I ever worked the door for was Super Bowl Sunday. I want to say it was 2010, maybe? 2010? Yeah, because by that point, I guess I would have been bartending and serving. So maybe 2009, maybe? Maybe Super Bowl Sunday, 2009, we had a show at Cicero's. I worked the door. Bar was empty. Restaurant was empty, because who goes out on Super Bowl Sunday?
Yeah.
There was a band, I believe they still play, they're called Harptalica. It's a duo, harp duo that covers Metallica songs.
All right.
Instrumentally, mind you, there's no vocals. Harptalica played Cicero's on Super Bowl Sunday. The opening band for Harptalica, Shattermask.
All right.
With the famed Diddler Priest as their singer. So not only was a harp band covering Metallica strange enough for me, Shattermask opening for them on Super Bowl Sunday was even weirder. Now it gets even crazier, because this dickhead threw up on stage, because that was like a thing he used to do, I guess. He threw up into a pitcher, maybe, because he did jujitsu moves, or Krav Maga, or capoeira, I guess, Brazilian dance fighting moves on stage during their terrible music. And he threw up on the stage, and he throws up on the stage, somebody else cleans it up, and he comes out of the venue. I'm sitting at the door, he comes out of the venue, and he goes, yeah, man, I just threw up all over the stage. Can't wait to talk about that in my next interview. And then he just walked off. Oh, and the postscript of that is eventually he got arrested for diddling.
Right.
Fucking rapist piece of shit. Yeah. So, yeah, that is the strangest gig I ever worked the door at Cicero's. Many nights with hippie shows, I became, my stance for hating hippies is pretty well known across the city. And I cemented it big time working the door at Cicero's. My favorite thing in the world next to playing music and going to bed every night next to my girlfriend Liz and my dog is telling hippies the word no. Maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. I do remember cruising down Highway 70 and seeing that billboard.
Oh yeah. That guy, yeah, wanted. Yeah. It went viral. It was so great. We all knew that guy sucked.
Yeah.
But we didn't know it was to that extent, man. I mean, we just figured he was a piece of shit, yeah. You know, just a trash person because his band was horrible and he was just arrogant in all the ways you shouldn't be arrogant. And we all got the last laugh on that guy.
Yeah.
I thought he would have killed himself, but
right.
Nope, still going, probably still trying to get Shattermass back together. He's learned his lesson, I guess.
Yeah. Our friend Brett writes in with a couple questions here. He asks, "What's your favorite scotch?"
My favorite scotch is relatively cheap when it comes to the scale that you can pay for scotch. I love a Glenlivet 12-year. Highland Scotch is my favorite. It's not very smoky and peaty, which is usually typically characteristic in scotch. Not so much for me. I really dig the honey and ginger finish that I get from a good Glenlivet 12-year. On the same tick, I really like Lagavulin, and I also enjoy the Macallan as well. But 12-year, at least, Highland Scotch. Nothing else. No blended scotches. Johnny Walker can fuck off.
And Brett also asked, how many bush cans is too many bush cans? Which I'd also like to mention, that was the sound of a bush can cracking.
Yeah, exactly. How many bush cans is two bush cans? The most beers I've ever drank in one entire day, I drank 22 bush beers one day.
Yeah?
Yeah, that's the most I've ever drank. So, and I felt pretty bad the next day. So I'd say 22 cans of bush is too many cans of bush. Brett.
Says, this one, I also do you like the new design or prefer the old school or maybe the camp design?
Bring the gold top back is what I say. I'd take the mid-2000s bush can with the gold top. I have a picture of me and my girlfriend Liz when we first started dating, and the gold top is on the table. So I prefer that one.
Yeah?
It reminds me of me being a kid. The classic can was cool, and I'm glad that they stuck with it for as long as they did. The new blue can's all right, but it reminds me, and I've been pointing this out by many people, it reminds me of a can of Blue Moon or something. So right. It's not appealing. The recipe hasn't changed, so truthfully, I don't give a fuck what can it comes in as long as the recipe doesn't change.
You know, that's one thing I don't get. Like, I mean, I guess it's got to be something, you know, to just a new cell thing, but like... You know, you look at all these beer, you know, it's like, you know, wider mouth.
Yeah, exactly. You just take a knife and you poke the top of the can, right. You got a wide mouth.
Yeah, dude. But just there's always some new thing that, like, to turn them, you know, now we got aluminum bottles, now we got twist off, you know, whatever.
It's like McDonald's still advertises, like, we don't know McDonald's exists. It's just keep putting beer out. Just, you know when people are going to be mad? When you stop selling it.
Yeah.
You know? Change it all you want. People are still going to buy it.
Yeah.
What slight upticks in sales... The marketing research tells you could happen from the branding changing.
Yeah.
It means nothing because people are still going to drink beers. People are still going to eat food. They got to go somewhere to get it.
Yeah.
Or was it George Carlin did a joke about like Coca-Cola still advertises? Really? Yeah,
right.
Did you know about this stuff?
I think my favorite's the camo cans because...
Oh, yeah. You
know, it's classic, you know, hunting and guns.
Oh,
and,
there's nothing and, like, and yeah, beer. Promoting getting really drunk and waving a hunting rifle around.
Right.
Yeah. Dick Cheneying somebody.
Yeah. I like that. That's a verb. You know, like
this. Yeah, exactly. I mean, I mean, you could look at that two ways. Dick Cheneying somebody could be shooting them accidentally with a hunting rifle, or sending thousands of humans to die in the desert for no reason.
Right. Either it's you know, and or. Corey Smith writes in, ask him about the good and bad. Times being in Last Flight Home.
Last Flight Home was my first band that I was in from Farmington, that band I was telling you about. The good times were opening for Cave-In once. That's who was my favorite modern rock band, by far and large. The worst times were when our drummer quit which I don't blame him for. We were young. Didn't matter to me. Don't hold it against him. And we got a replacement drummer, and we took him on tour with us, and he tried to dose me with meth one time. That was not good.
Yeah?
Yeah. I never found out about it. I was completely sober at the time. I didn't drink or anything at all. This was before all this, and our drummer was just a piece of shit meth guy.
Huh.
That I didn't know at the time. None of us knew at the time. This came out later on that I was drinking hot tea. That was my thing. I liked to drink hot tea and at the time. And he was going to put meth in my hot tea. And that sucks.
Yeah.
That it didn't happen, thank God. But, yeah, that's probably the worst time was when we had to hire... we didn't even hire him because we weren't getting paid. But we had the guy play drums in our band that tried to dose me with meth. That sucked.
Yeah.
Other than that, I had a lot of good times with that band. We played good shows.
Yeah. Ryan Mills writes in, how many pancakes have you eaten in one sitting?
I'm not a big contest eater guy, but I will say I have seen a man eat 14 pancakes before in one sitting at a Denny's in Springfield, Illinois. It was the all-you-can-eat pancakes for $4 at Denny's. They only bring you two at a time.
Right.
He convinced the waitress to bring them three at a time, and with no syrup, he put 14 of them back. So, Casey, the drummer from Anodes, did that. I'm not a big contest eater guy.
Yeah.
I can't do too much at once. But if I can sort of answer that question with a story, that's how I would answer that. I have seen a human being eat 14 before. He probably could have eaten more, he said, too. But, I mean, 14. Yeah.
That's pretty impressive.
That's a lot of pancakes, yeah. Man. With no... Just butter, though. No syrup.
Right.
No syrup. Syrup just slows you down, I guess.
Yeah. Let's see what else we got here. Brad also writes in, favorite gig you have ever played.
Favorite gig I ever played. It's a tie. Roadburn in the Netherlands was pretty incredible because I mean, as a band that plays extreme music, where you can't just walk in the door and enjoy our stuff, you kind of have to know what it is you're getting yourself into before you really can enjoy our kind of music. Extreme metal in general is a very niche market. So the Netherlands has a festival called Roadburn Festival. To heavy, doom, psych, rock, grindcore, death metal, extreme music in all ways. Even like Scott H. Byram, you know who that guy is?
Yeah.
Scott H. Byram played Roadburn the same day we did.
Right.
So it just kind of, it's an attitude. It's I don't even know how to really describe it. In a weird bohemian sort of rock and it's all, I mean... It's all rock and roll to me, really, when it comes down to it. It's a bunch of subgenres living off the rock and roll mythos that we've all been sold, that you play shows on big stages for a lot of people, and they're going crazy, and you have it in every genre.
Mm-hmm.
So Roadburn was probably the best gig we've ever played, in my opinion, because it was in another country, for one. I was thousands of miles away from my hometown, and a room was packed with, albeit only 150, maybe 175 people, but... In another country, there was a line out the door to see our band. And that's never happened anywhere we've ever played before.
Yeah,
domestically, my favorite gig? Man, we've played a lot. Any of the shows that we've played, the St. Vitus gig with Mournful Congregation on my 30th birthday was pretty awesome. My dad, Bob Newstead, we call him Newt. Everyone calls him Newt. My dad drove Pfister on tour 3 years ago. For a two-week tour, and one of the shows happened to be at St. Vitus in Brooklyn, which is my favorite place to play ever. You've never had a venue cater to metal bands more than St. Vitus. The black decor to the mannequin wearing the bar shirt with corpse paint on his face, and just upside-down crosses, and just black veils, and skeets, and the loudest fucking sound system for the room that I played in a long time.
Yeah.
So we played there. We got on Martyr Doom Fest, and... it was my 30th birthday. I was away from home, but my dad was there, and we opened for, I mean, the best funeral doom band in the game, Mournful Congregation. They're from Australia, too, and I think at that point they may only played like 5 or 6 shows in the U.S., never in Brooklyn. And they played 2 nights on that festival, and we opened for them. So that's probably my favorite stateside gig was Mournful Congregation, and favorite the favorite of all time is Roadrun, for sure. Yep.
Very cool. Josh writes in, can he comment on the time he worked at Cicero's, given the recent news, when we had secret shows of other bands, we used a blow-up doll and a tip bucket and wrote Marcus on it.
Yeah, that was my effigy for the door guy. So I was working the door for the Matty Hoochie shows back in the day. That was where my real hatred of hippies came out big time. My comments about working at Cicero's, I'll keep short and sweet, really. I worked there for a long time. One part of the time I worked there, it was really cool to work there. I felt like I was really a part of something cool, and then it became very sour.
Yeah.
Most employees that worked there would have comments about it. Not to get deep into it, I learned a lot from working there. I'll just suffice to say that I learned a great deal about service, hospitality, and I've seen some, and I will say this too, I've seen some pretty incredible people. I worked with some pretty incredible people over there.
Sure.
So it hosted a lot of great talent in the industry that I've made my life, and a lot of people I know, a lot of the people that I've met, even in music still, it lends itself to let someone work at a restaurant or a bar that involves itself in music to make it, you know, cohesive as a community where there is consumer and there is supplier. Mm-hmm. You know, the bar gives the drinks, the restaurant gives the food, the venue gives the music. So it taught me a lot. It really did. Both ends of it. Both ends of it. So yeah, I would say never again would I work in an environment like that ever again, but it did a lot of good for a lot of people.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's sad. It's sad that it's going away.
Yeah.
It was the best. I to this day maintain it's the best sounding small room we had in St. Louis. If you want a pretty kick-ass 100-person show, there was no better room in town for that than Cicero's. The sound system was incredible. John, who was the for many years the house sound guy, is brilliant. Could make a band sound incredible. Colin, who they had running sound for them a long time, made band sound incredible. My buddy Mike Walsh did sound up there for a long time. A guy known named Sam. Gary Copeland did sound there for a while. A lot of guys who know what they're doing ran that room, and it sounded really good. Band sounded really good there.
Yeah, man. It's a shame. Yeah, I've been to a lot of great shows there.
Hopefully that PA goes somewhere or they make that a venue for something else. I always wished that one day they would just cement the fucking door to the restaurant and just make it you'd probably have to. Maybe a little an alleyway to get out so they had a back door. So there's not one entrance and one exit, but, you know, make the venue separate from the restaurant and you'd had it. I mean, man. Just would have been so crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you'd have to have someone working the door outside, but it just it's perfect. It's perfect for small stuff. Seen every kind of band there.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I saw metal bands, jazz bands, hippie bands. Good rap shows, bad rap shows. You know, fucking country shows. Mock Orange played there when I worked there, so I got to see Mock Orange there. The Life and Times played there, which has guys from Shiner. So I mean, legendary Midwestern rock bands have played there. After it moved, you know, in the current space.
Yeah.
So it had a lot of history. Even in people want to talk a big game, it was in the new space longer than it was in the old space. You know, they had 19 years. Technically, they had 19 years in the old space, but they had 20 in the new space. So.
Huh. Kelsey McClure writes in, I want to know when he's going to tell jokes again. He destroyed a few times. He got up at O'Malley's. And this was something new, man. I didn't realize you... But you told me last night that you did some comedy.
I used to be a once a weeker in the comedy scene in St. Louis about 5 years ago.
Yeah.
Kelsey was a fellow comic. I don't even want to call myself a comic. Kelsey was a comic that did a lot of shows with me, or I did a lot of shows that she was on for open mics and stuff like that. I was only on one featured show ever, or two featured shows ever. One time I ruined my appearance by breaking down because the bit I had in my head didn't go the way that I was performing it. Wasn't landing very well, and I tanked it on purpose. Wasn't good. Very, very, very not pretty. The other paid gig that I did, I didn't even think I got paid. It was just a showcase. It was an open mic. It was downtown. It was upstairs at the Tin Can, and it went pretty well.
Yeah.
But I was an open mic guy, and then I hosted an open mic at O'Shea's in the Grove for a little bit. Rick Giordano from The Lion's Daughter used to do comedy too. That's kind of a thing. I don't know, not many people know about that. I don't know how cool he'd be with me telling people that, but I mean, it's out there. People know Rick did it. And honestly, I started doing it because Rick's comedy was incredible, and we actually got together and wrote stuff a couple times, and it was pretty awesome. Very nihilistic comedy Rick had. It was pretty cool. He taught me, George Carlin originally taught me, that you could be mad as fuck and be funny. And Rick is a very misanthropic, angry guy. I mean, I've never listened to The Lion's Daughter before. But it's very, very bleak. Very bleak, very heavy stuff.
Right.
They're definitely our brother band as far as the metal band. We did a split with them. We did a tour with them. We did two tours with them, actually. But yeah, Rick was doing comedy, and his comedy was just like mean and just fucking nihilistic and heavy and like dark, but not like groaner dark. You know, it was like, it's like, oh man, yeah, wow, you know.
Sure.
So, and I've my whole life I've always tried to be a cut up. I've always tried to make people laugh just because it's just how I am. Like I don't try to be uncomfortably funny to people. I try to make people feel comfortable, and if I can make them laugh a little bit, then it's all right, you know? Mm-hmm. I've just always been that kind of guy. I don't like... I like to add a little levity to the situation in any way that I can. Yeah. So Rick did comedy. I saw him do... I did a show. I wrote 6-7 jokes, half of them about weed. tried to use my vocabulary, enunciate a little bit, and people started laughing, so I started doing open mic at O'Malley's. Eventually started working at O'Malley's, too, on Mondays, bartending, and then I would do the open mic that night, but... I had some good times doing comedy. It was fun. I had a lot of friends. Like, I made friends with a lot of people in a very short amount of time with how accepted I was in that scene. And they were very nice to me. They treated me very well. You know, and I never felt... I'm a tourist in that scene as well, too. So I feel like I got... The reason I got out of it, too, is because I... Watching people who put as much time into it as these guys and these women and all the people who make it their life, I have an ultimate respect for anybody who has creativity and has an outlet for it. And those people put themselves out there hard as fuck. Mm-hmm. More so than musicians are, because you can be louder than people most of the time.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You can drown out people who don't want to watch what you do, and you get up there with just a microphone, and if you don't make people listen to you, then it's murder. And even when you put so much time and you think about how you deliver your material and stuff, and you don't see it work, like you know it should, standards are set in your mind and they're not met. So I got out of comedy mainly because I felt like I wasn't writing anymore, too, because I was hosting an open mic, and I became the guy that warmed up the crowd and then introduced the comics and hope to God I pronounced their names the right way.
Yeah.
And it became a fucking chore, and I had an anxiety attack at one of the performances, and I had to like make someone else host the rest of the night, and I was already passing off the hosting duties to someone else, and I just didn't feel like I had as much love to give it as I do music. Music was really picking up for me, too, because that year I quit comedy was the first year I started to... I knew Pfister was going to start picking up, so I had to kind of make a decision. Like, if I'm going to do comedy, I'm going to write material. I'm going to write 2 hours worth of material, and then I'm going to showcase it, and then I'm going to showcase an hour of it at these open mics, and then I'm going to keep an hour of it back in the backlog, and then... another, you know, 2 months or whatever, I'll get that other hour of material out and I'll showcase it with those open mics over the course of a month and a half or whatever. And it just didn't work out that way. Mm-hmm. I have like 3 hours of rehearsed material that I could do since I quit doing comedy that I just don't want to do. It got really weird, too. It was like to the point where I was like shouting at people to keep their attention, and I just really wanted to interact with the crowd too much. You can't do that. You can't give... You're talking to the people. You're not talking with them. Right. You're talking to them. And I feel like I started just talking with the people, and I was just... Man, and it really triggered a lot of, like, aggressiveness in me. Huh. As far as, like... it wasn't confrontational, really. But I would like to just... I'd shut people down. No one heckled me at all, ever. You could ask any comic that I ever did an open mic with back in the day. No one ever heckled me because I was more than likely meaner than the person heckling me, or eventually made them scared of me by how mean I would be back to them. Like, it would be incredible how mean I would be to hecklers. I would just destroy them. A fellow comic wanted to fight me one time while I was on stage. He was all back in the back of O'Malley's, just walking back and forth, and then they kicked him out, and the owner of O'Malley's, Tommy Gage, came out and gave him a talking to and settled him down and kicked him out of there for good. It was just, you know, I have a really good grasp at, I can pick out something to talk to people about very well if I have one thing. Mm-hmm. Writing a list of jokes out never felt right to me. I felt like I was one-linering people, and that's just not what I do.
Right.
You know? Anybody can be quirky.
Sure. I totally relate with, you know, being kind of accepted into that community and stuff like you're saying. How I was going to Funny Bone, like, every Sunday for a while there. And
yeah.
Like, just because they give you all those passes for the Kilo Diabetes Foundation or whatever. So I was going, like, every Sunday, and I catch the headliner, and I just started to, you know, once you're there so many times, you start. I started meeting all the, you know, features and the host and the bartenders and the wait staff and everybody, and like I kind of became my cheers after a while.
That's,
you know,
cool.
And like it was just these are people, and now I've made great friends just through started going to comedy shows and stuff.
Oh, dude, people that I met, I definitely want to fucking Kenny Kynes, Frankie Chubb, yeah. Kelsey McClure for sure was awesome. Hang out back then. John Vangoni, a great friend of mine. Max Fitzgerald definitely helped me get going back in the day.
All friends of the show.
Big time. Who else? I know so many other people. Christian Lawrence, who did Punch Drunk Comedy.
Yeah.
Bare Knuckle Comedy is what it's called now. Right. Who else? Kevin White was back in the day. I knew him. He helped me out getting some shows early, mm-hmm. too. Wanted to collaborate with me, but I just never could write with anybody else, you know? Man. I mean, I hung out with a lot of people back in those days. And Andrew Fossen is another dude who is low-key. Awesome. Who, I don't know, does stuff that much these days, but he's good as fuck.
Mm-hmm.
Fuck.
Yeah.
So many people I don't see hardly. I saw Kenny Kynes the other night, as a matter of fact. I ran into him. We had band practice here, and then we went to the Crow's Nest. Kenny is one of the owners of the Crow's Nest now. We went up there to hang out after band practice, and the comedy show started, and I was just like, holy shit, there's a comedy show. Felt so bad for those people, man. Another thing, too, is I was doing too many open mics where it was just me and the other comics, and I'm fleshing material out to other people who don't care about it. Like, they're cool, and they're my friends, and they want to work on their jokes, too, you know? Like, so I didn't want to take up any more of their time, man. I have more to say musically than I ever did comedy-wise.
Right.
But I met some awesome people, made some awesome fucking friends. JC Sabala was an awesome dude, helped me out earlier. Charlie Winfrey's crazy ass. Steve Poggi, who I don't even know if he remembers me and all or not, but the dude was awesome on stage. He was very nice to me whenever I did open mics. You know, again, probably didn't look at me as like a tourist, as other than just a dude who's doing comedy, but
right.
Which was pretty awesome. And then Nikki Glaser, before she blew up, was open, yeah. was already doing bigger stuff than all of the people that I was associating with and me myself. But she was doing open mics. I mean, she did open mics at O'Malley's. I was on many shows with her, you know.
Yeah.
Like, very, you know, not a collie at all. Doesn't remember me, you know. Again, not a comic now. Why the fuck would she remember me? No big deal. Don't care. But, you know, it was that was going on. So, comedy had its place. Good scene in St. Louis. Somebody from Cincinnati, comic from Cincinnati, told me that we had a good comedy scene.
Yeah.
Big time. And I agree. Helium, I don't know what it's doing for the scene. Looks like it's bringing good comics through, giving local comics a good chance to open for them,
yeah.
Which is what you got to do. I mean, you got to get your material out to the people who go to pay for the shit, who want to be there, not bar patrons in an open mic where you don't know if some drunk asshole is going to throw a fucking glass at you or try to fight you, like I said, has happened to me before. So, I mean, you have paid audience, you got an outlet, you got a stage that people are supposed to be there, they're supposed to listen to the comedy, and they're supposed to laugh. They want to laugh. No one goes out to a comedy show they paid for to be a cold fish, you know. They just don't want to not be moved. So those opportunities just weren't. I mean, I wasn't doing that, so music became way more important to me. And then it is now the main focus of my life. My goal for when I become decrepit and old is to be playing a guitar somewhere.
Yeah.
One way or the other.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
Well, you can come see Marcus play some guitar. Got a bunch of dates coming up, and you mentioned Daybringer. You guys will be at
FUBAR.
FUBAR on the...
Yeah, Daybringer, yeah. Real quick, I didn't really talk about it earlier, but yeah. I'll suffice to say that Daybringer is next to Grand Inquisitor, the most challenging band that I play, and big time, because the talent of the other musicians is just out of this world. And we have a show coming up with Planes Mistaken for Stars, who I really want to say the last time I think they were in St. Louis might have been over 10 years ago. And it was with the Ataris,
yeah.
And the band Hopes Fall. I don't know if you've ever heard of them or not. But it was the Ataris were the headlining band, then Hopes Fall, and then Planes Mistaken for Stars opened that show. Very diverse bill. opening band, nothing like the closing band. I mean, the history that Plans for Taking for Stars has as a band in the hardcore scene for years, they did a lot of work, you know, and this is their first time back at St. Louis for a long time, so it's pretty awesome that Bob wanted us to open for them. So yeah, we're going to be playing that show with Sepperer, and then Kill Ever, I believe is the name of the other band on that show. I feel like a dick right now because it's not... I'm right now real quick going to look up the other band because I feel like a dick. But it's us, Sepperer, is this new band in St. Louis that is definitely killing it. My buddy Eli and my buddy Evan, who I've known for years, are playing in that band. Let me see. It's Plans Mistaken for Stars at Foo Bar with... Oh, man. Killeaver, I believe, is the name of the thing. God. Kilvarez. God, I suck so bad. Kilvarez. Kilvarez is a really good band, too, and I'm really bad that I don't... Man, yeah, that's not good that I don't know that.
Yeah.
I should have known that off the top of my head. But I'm ashamed of myself that I haven't seen them play yet. And if I see a band play, then I know them forever. But I remember looking them up, and I remember seeing they have badass gear, and I listened to their music. Their music's awesome. So, yeah, Kilvarez, I'm very sorry. They don't know me. They're not going to fucking listen to this. Right. I have a lot of respect for your band and your art and your talent as musicians. I saw your gear. The music is good. I'm very sorry, Kilvarez, that I didn't know your band name off the top of my head for this show of one of the fucking four bands that I play in.
Right.
Over the course of the next month is playing. Your band is good. I will be there, obviously, to watch your band play. So, yes. Sorry. I'm sorry. So, yeah. And boom. Kilvarez.
Daybringer will also be at the Sinkhole on July 29th with friends of the show, the Mass Brothers.
Oh, yeah. And Anodes and the best metal band in St. Louis next to the Gorge and Black Fast, the Lion's Daughter.
Yeah.
Those are the three best metal bands in St. Louis.
Yeah, for sure.
Easy.
But yeah, man, this has been great getting to hang and talk and talking. You know, I think we covered everything. But yeah, you said you we are here at practice. You have a guitar.
Yeah,
you said you you had a song stuck in your head this morning when you walked in, wanted to do a little jamming for us. So close this out with a little Marcus Neustadt on guitar.
Thank you. Rock Paper Podcast.
Well, yeah, that was it.